Welcome, everybody. Thanks very much for coming to Brookings at the Carnegie Endowment. I am sorry that we weren't able to host you at Brookings today, but as you may have seen, there's rather serious security presence, a lot of Russian agents walking around. That's because President Medvedev is going to be speaking later on today at Brookings, so we had to shift to here. But thank you for joining us. I'm Martin Indyk, the Vice President for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. We're very honoured to have the opportunity to hear from Tarun Das today. Steve Cohen, our resident senior fellow, who's very much the preeminent expert in Washington on all things to do with India, will introduce Tarun and moderate the discussion. I just wanted to welcome everybody and just say that this is part of a new initiative at Brookings, the South Asia Initiative, in which we are pooling the considerable talent of our experts and scholars on South Asia to focus on India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and many of the issues involved in U.S. policy in the South Asia region in a way that can take advantage of the considerable resources scholarship that we have at Brookings to focus attention on the kinds of issues that this important region poses for United States policy. So, again, Tarun, thank you very much for gracing us with your presence today, and I'll hand over to Steve. Thank you.
First, it's my pleasure to announce, those of you who don't know it already, because Mina is here, that no Brookings scholar has won the Pulitzer Prize, but a Brookings trustee has won a Brookings a Pulitzer Prize. So we're very pleased to... Mina? Leah Kopka. It's not widely recognized that India is one of the most revolutionary states and societies in the world today, and has been for 40-plus years, almost 60 years. India was born with the most unequal society in the world. The caste system defined people inherently as unequal. India was born with the most unequal economic system in the world, a largely agricultural society with a top layer of the super rich, mostly princes but a few Indian businesses who looked inward, not outward. India has also seen revolutionary changes in its educational system and its engagement with technology, and this has produced one of the great successes of modern India, even of the world, of India's entry into the high technology sector. When globalization came to India, it was able to withstand the negative dimensions and take advantage of the positive ones. And I think we underestimate the negative consequences of globalization for many states around the world, especially countries like Pakistan. Indian business was truly part of this revolutionary vanguard, and in most ways remains ahead of the Indian state, which still contains elements of the Raj. Tarun Das is an unlikely revolutionary. Looking at him now, Tarun, I wouldn't suspect you're being a revolutionary. On the other hand, Bengal has produced a tradition of revolutionaries, Subhas Chandra Bose and many others. But he has been at the forefront of the revolution for more than 35 years as he transformed the Confederation of Indian Industries from a small engineering association into an entity that does much more than lobbying, but leads the government and has its own foreign service, including the Kiran Pasricha, who is, in a sense, the ambassador of CII to Washington, has been for many years a very effective ambassador also. The 1990s, Tarun was among the first to spot the opportunities offered by liberalization. Tarun and CII urged the government to deepen and extend reforms, which they have done, and to the degree they have done that, India has prospered in ways which I never would have imagined when I first went to India in 1963. Tarun Das has now hung up his chapels. And after 30 years of serving as Director General of CII and nearly 6 years as CII's chief mentor, and looking up the internet, there are very few mentors around the world. One, I guess, the former head of Infosys, and also, of course, my favorite Singapore former leader, Lee Kuan Yew. He's minister mentor, but it's almost a unique title, but I think well deserved. Today it is fitting and reflective of the revolution still underway in India that Charun will address us on making growth inclusive, a challenge that goes to the heart of both the moral and practical compulsions of India's ongoing revolutions. Charun? Okay.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you. And thank you, Martin. And thank you, Brookings, for having me here. It's a great privilege to be with you. I was thinking about what to speak about and what to cover and how to get away from the usual stuff about the economy and, you know, all of that, growth, etc. And recently, very recently, we had Tim Geithner in Delhi. And the Treasury Secretary was truly outstanding in engaging India and Indians. But at dinner, he asked a question that triggered this thought process in my mind. He said, what are we missing about India? What are we missing about India? And I thought I would talk about some of the issues which are probably not, you know, discussed enough. Not new, not original, but just a whole bunch of almost invisible things happening in India and which will shape India's future. So I'm going to focus on, in very brief kind of bullet point terms, on 15 issues. And I'll start with the first one, which is a new and steadily rising trend of private sector CEOs coming into government for public service. Now, this is completely new in India. It's never happened before. India's run by its civil service, its iron frame left behind by the British. And they have protected their turf well. But now the Prime Minister in this current incarnation, as in his second term, has started doing this. There are three outstanding examples. One is Nandan Nilekani, who is co-chair, CEO of Infosys Technologies, who's handling a major nation-transforming project on identity cards and identities for a billion plus people. Or an Arun Myra, in fact, the first multinational CEO, the CEO of Boston Consulting Group, BCG, who was actually an American citizen when the Prime Minister asked him to join his Council of Ministers. So he had to give up his American citizenship rapidly and get an Indian citizenship even more rapidly to be able to be sworn in and join the Council of Ministers. He's in the Planning Commission. He's reorganizing and restructuring the way government works, apart from driving the industrial policy, the urban development issues of the country. And a third example is a guy from Mahindra & Mahindra, a large business group, Raghuraman, who's come as the CEO of something called NatGrid. And this is the National Intelligence Grid, which has been established by Home Minister Chidambaram. And he went out to the private sector to get the CEO into government. So point number one, a new development. More happening, more people will be joining, more in the pipeline. You'll hear about it. Point two. In 2007, when we celebrated India at 60, that is 60 years of independence in New York, we invited C.K. Prahlad to come over and give the keynote of not India at 60, but India at 75. And so what would it be? What would India have to do over the next 15 years? And one issue which he covered, a very big issue, was that we would have to train 500 million young people. 500 million young people. And we would have to skill them, essentially through vocational training, and all kinds of skills, from basic skills to industrial skills and all of that. Now, that paper of C.K. Prahlad was sort of driven into the government system over several months, and the President of India, in her address to Parliament recently, announced that this was a national target of 500 million young people to be skilled. Now, how do we do that? Is it going to be government? The government said, the Prime Minister said, it will not be the government. And it established something called the National Skills Corporation, which is a public-private partnership, 51% equity with private sector, chairman and CEO from the private sector, a mixed board of private sector and government, and charged with the responsibility of training every kind of Indian over the next 15 to 20 years. They have a website, and anybody interested can look at that. So, major initiative on empowering people in India through the Skills Corporation as the central agency to drive this agenda. Third, innovation and technology, much neglected in India because we were a protected economy. We were divorced from competition for 50 years until liberalization started in the 90s, and innovation really just was not happening. As competition has grown and as we have tried to find new ways of doing things in India, we're seeing very interesting developments of innovation within the country, locally developed, creative work being done. And I'll give you just one example, for example, is if you take telecom towers, and we have 500 million telecom cell phone connections now and growing rapidly at about 5 to 10 million a month. The telecom towers use diesel. So can you imagine the cost, the pollution, and the whole messy arrangement of having to work these telecom towers using diesel? So we are on a national mission to green the telecom towers and to move from diesel to renewable energies to, you know, provide power to these telecom towers. A second example is solar lanterns, very cheap solar lanterns being provided to the villages. 60% of India, once it's dark, they live in the dark. All right? That's not perhaps known. Now, solar lanterns are being provided to villages across the country so that children can study in the evening and women can cook and whatever, you know, normal life can happen. So just two examples and I'll move on. Four, the much maligned public sector, set up in the 50s by Jawaharlal Nehru. Many of the public sector companies have declined, but many are in strategic industries, capital goods, steel, petroleum, gas. And we were always very concerned about their efficiency, their competitiveness, their contribution to the national economy. Again, in this last year, since the Prime Minister won the election and came back to government, we are seeing restructuring of the public sector, disinvestment, more shares with the public of India, with institutions, less with the government, and a new drive to make these strategic public sector corporations effective. Because we have taken a view as a country that privatization is not a solution for everything. And when you look back on the last year and a half of the global financial downturn, and India has been somewhat lucky to have minimal impact of that, there's a clear view in India that the public sector has a role to play. and therefore let's see how to make them more efficient, how to make them more long-lasting in a competitive environment, and that's happening. Next, education. The education minister, the HR minister, has been around in the U.S. visiting universities. He brought a delegation of university heads with him. But more important is that education is being opened to the private sector, and private sector corporations are doing strange things. The Azim Premji Foundation, which is an offshoot of Wipro, is providing primary education to hundreds and thousands of schools in the south of India. The Bharti Foundation in the north of India, which is run by the biggest telecom company, Airtel, is providing primary education to 1,000 schools between Rajasthan and Punjab, two states. This never happened before, and this is a growing phenomenon of private sector coming into the education field to supplement and complement what the government does through public schools. The other dimension of this is that the private sector is setting up a school of public policy, a school of infrastructure studies, and with foreign collaboration. And I know that some of these people are also trying to engage institutions like Brookings to see whether, you know, there could be foreign collaboration. And there's nothing in policy to prohibit this. So this is another new development happening beyond just foreign investment in universities. This is where private sector and partners abroad can come together to provide different kinds of education and different kinds of research services in the country. Healthcare. In India, 80% of healthcare is in the private sector. But what is perhaps not known is the spread of mobile health clinics, of telemedicine, and of low-cost health services across the country, making healthcare affordable to even the poorest of the poor. Agriculture and food. 60% of our population dependent on agriculture and food sector. Very poor, living in the rural areas. But transformation taking place through new technologies, through supply lines which are being improved, dealing with the issue of wastage of food. 40% of our fruits and vegetables were being wasted because there was no proper storage. And all of this is now being handled in a very different way, again, with a large contribution and participation from the private sector, including multinationals. India, with 200 years of British rule, was very much employment culture nation. I mean, everybody was an employee. In the 90s, when the liberalization started, business and industry, which had been protected at that time for 40, 50 years, were very scared of competition. And they were very concerned that they would be wiped out. Now, if you fast forward to where we are today, we've got companies who are competitive, who are confident, who are globalizing, who are acquiring companies abroad. The new priority, in fact, is to invest in the U.S. And every case of investment in the U.S. over the last few years has led to more profitability and additional employment in the U.S. Not one Indian company has had a different experience from so it's always been a turnaround case. Very often they are buying into companies which are in difficulty, turning them around and moving ahead. But in the country, there's an explosion of entrepreneurship. There's an explosion of young entrepreneurship. Our children don't want to work for someone else anymore. The children are wanting to do their own thing and be self-employed. So this is a new phenomenon which we are seeing in the Indian situation, which I thought, you know, I would mention. And this is very different from the past history of, you know, me working all my life in an institution, or my father working all his life in a company, my grandfather working all his life for government. Our children are wanting to do things, and there is opportunity, there's space to do that and to make good on that, both in services and in manufacturing. In fact, we are seeing now 100,000 small and medium enterprises in India which are successful and are competitive. Now, this was just unheard of in the past because they were all controlled and regimented and handcuffed, and there was no question of their being competitive. Most of the time, they were whining for more protection so that they could, you know, just survive. And that situation has changed dramatically. And you will see us, these small, medium enterprises, coming more and more into prominence as we go forward. In fact, I feel that apart from doing this big boys club, the CEOs forum between India and US, we really need to talk about an SMEs forum between both sides, because both countries have great strengths in entrepreneurship and enterprise. Next point, the private sector, and this follows from the earlier point of entrepreneurship. The private sector was maybe in the corner of the room for 50 years, maybe most of the time out of the room where the action was in India. The private sector was mistrusted. The private sector was always an excuse to set up more public sector companies in the country rather than encourage the private sector. And all that changed from the 90s. And the private sector today has moved from out of the room into the room, and actually into the center of the room, and is the driving force of growth, of development, of globalization. And it's happened in a very, very quick time, in about 15 years, which is not even, you know, one generation or one lifetime. So, and this looks like continuing, because we are seeing, again, I mentioned this entrepreneurship, I mentioned this enterprise spirit which has come. So we are seeing more and more engagement of the private sector in India's development and growth. Last year, acquisitions by the private sector abroad were $5 billion plus. This year, it's just, 3 months now, the first quarter of the year, it's about $12 billion this year. And so by the end of the year, we'll probably end up with about $20 billion of investments abroad. So small figures still, but growing. And so a new phenomenon is this private sector role and competitiveness in the Indian context. Next is, what is transforming the rural areas in particular is technology, is television, it's telecom and IT, because they're connecting people. Connecting people to the mainstream of India's economy and the mainstream of India's society. So this is an amazing, invisible change which is happening in the country, and again, leading to its own impetus and momentum for growth and development. There are lots of articles which I read and which I see which talk about India's consumption, and lots of consumers, middle class, buying more, demand growing, etc., etc. But we are a very mixed up country, mixed up people. We're also saving more. So our savings rate was 25%. It's gone up to 35%. We're also investing more. So when you look at India and you look at Indians, we are very cautious. We're entrepreneurial, but cautious. We're spending more, we're saving more of our earnings, and we're investing more. So you're just not just spending more. You need to mention that. So it's not an over-leveraged society, and it's not an over-leveraged economy because of this caution and this conservatism that, which is there in an Indian. That, you know, I need to provide for the future, education for kids, home for the future, and all of that. So this is a cultural issue with us Indians, which I wanted to mention. I'm coming to the end of my last couple of points. One is government schemes. A government is spending an enormous amount on all kinds of development schemes, and they are not successful. They are very inefficient. They are very... Rajiv Gandhi said once when he was prime minister that only 15% of the money reaches the people. And there is no reason to believe that that statistic has changed. Maybe it's now 10% instead of 15%. So the government has instituted a process of bypass surgery. And this bypass surgery is to go in for public-private partnerships for implementation of programs, involve the NGOs, involve the industry. The NGOs have grassroots connections and knowledge and experience. Business and industry has the capability to implement. This is what business does best. Organize yourself, manage, implement. This is a business core competence. They know how to do things. And government is very good at the concept, what to do. So this marriage is taking place across the country in different programs, which is going to, I think, change the way that we get all these social sector programs done, which have been failing in the past because government were doing it all on their own. There is a huge, silent social reform agenda taking place. The Right to Information Act, the Right to Education Act, the Rural Employment Guarantee Act, the Women's Reservation Bill, the Communal Harmony Bill, the Food Security Act. All this is about empowering the poor. All this eventually means affirmative action through policies, through laws, and through initiatives by the government to empower people who are discriminated against or who have a vote but are really disenfranchised. You know, they don't really have a place in society. So this is something very important which is happening more in the last 1 year than ever before, and which is, again, creating, building an increasing numbers of people who are employed or self-employed, who are earning, who are saving, and who are therefore adding to the size of the cake. That's the economy, the market, as we call it in the country. My last point is that we are trying to build in India, through all this, a new economic and social development model, really, the like of which probably has not been tried. Billion people, inclusive growth and inclusive development through a social reform agenda, different government programs involving the private sector and NGOs, and creating a new way. So it's not a capitalist economy. It's not a socialist economy. It's not a communist nation. But it's mixed up in different ways. And there's some kind of a pattern to all of this. And where do we think we'll go? I think we'll converge between social development and economic development and take India to 10% growth over the next few years and stay there for a long time, because that's the only way we see poverty being eradicated. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tarun, for a truly revolutionary statement.
And having lived in India since 1963, it is a revolution. And I think that was a brilliant, concise statement of the revolution ongoing. I will forego my host's privileges and not ask the first question. Maybe I'll ask the last question. But let's have questions from the audience, comments. Mina's husband, Liaquat Ahmed, won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction, for Masters of...
For history,
Masters of the Universe.
I have a two-part question. I apologize for doing that. But one, when we visited Reliance Industries in Bombay, they had talked about vertical integration of the agricultural sector. And I had one concern because we all know that the agricultural sector has had some real issues. And the concern was that if they do indeed try and collectivize the farmers and buy everything from them and get rid of the middleman, there may be a time where the infrastructure disappears for the farmers to alternative markets, and then they rely on Reliance. And what if Reliance then pushes down the prices that they're willing to pay the farmers? And how will the government protect industry from not manipulating the farmers to their disadvantage? And then the second part is all your 15 points are based on the assumption that there's a political environment that's stable. And given even Manmohan Singh, Dr. Manmohan Singh has said that the Marxist issue has really become a serious problem in India, not to mention what's going on the Western front. But how do you view that, because those people are disenfranchised, and how are you planning to pull those into the mainstream sector? Thank you.
I think that what Reliance want to do will have to be a very long-term process. And one of the issues in India is that historically the private sector has not been trusted by society for the very reason that they were seen as exploiters, right? I don't see that governments will step back and let the farmer be at the mercy of any private sector company, so irrespective of who it is. And let's say that the best role model of the private sector in India is Tata's, you know, the best reputation, highest goodwill, highest level of trust. But even then, I think the government will be there to see. The farmer may be very poor, may seem to be powerless, but has enormous power in the country, you know, enormous political power in the country. And the farmer goes and votes. Business doesn't often go and vote. So I see that the safeguards will always be there to make sure that the farmers are taken care of. Let's take the example of big corporates wanting to set up special economic zones, what are known as SEZs in the country. This was an initiative of the previous government led by Congress before 2009. Hasn't happened. Why hasn't it happened? Issue of land, issue of resistance of farmers. I mean, whether it's political or otherwise, the nano project moved from West Bengal to Gujarat because for 400 acres of land, the farmers were not willing to sell the land. So there are, I think if you look at what's happening in India, there's special economic zones which are supposed to be export zones, supposedly good for the country in terms of investment, economic growth, etc., just not happened because of the land issue, and which is connected to the farmer. So, yes, it's a concern, but I think it's a concern which will be taken care of because that's the way the system works. And if people stand up and, you know, are not happy about something, it can't be pushed through by an individual corporate or groups of corporates. Your second point about stability, I think we have political stability, both at the federal level and at the state levels now. I'm also seeing a change in the state levels where the state governments are doing much more for development than they ever did. They're much more responsible. I mean, if you look at a basket case like Bihar, I mean, one change, one election, been a transformation in Bihar. And this is a story which some states have gone down. Andhra, which was doing extremely well because of recent problems on this Telangana issue, is going through challenging times and difficulties right now. But I would see stability across the country in that. Now, as far as the Naxalites and the Maoists are concerned, which is the north to south belt through the center of India, there is a new confidence in the management of internal security under Chidambaram, the Home Minister. There really is. We did not have that confidence right up to 2611 and beyond in Bombay. I think there is a new confidence. He's brought about enormous change. But yes, it's a long way to go. He's trying to reform the police. This great man has just written a book, which you will get in a couple of months' time, I think, which will study some of these issues. But I think we are feeling much better now about internal security. Doesn't mean the problems are going to go away overnight. But I think a year from now, 2 years from now, you will see a great change in the internal security situation in India. It's both. It's about equipping ourselves to deal with it, but also in terms of development. There's a lot of development work going on in the areas where there are people who are taking to violence, who are taking to arms.
Gentleman back there, and could you state your name, please? And, and your affiliation, if any.
Yes, my name is Rahul Madhavan with Johns Hopkins SAIS down the road, and thank you for your comments. Arvind Subramaniam, an economist just opposite the road, has described India as a precocious economy and country in which it's skipped the industrial revolution that typifies most developing economies and has emerged as a service-led economy. I was wondering if you could describe, through your experience and your insight, what India's industrial and manufacturing sectors are going to look like over the next few decades, and whether the state is going to play an enabling role or an perhaps inhibitive role.
The Indian manufacturing industry, till the mid-90s, had the lowest self-esteem and lowest self-confidence because they had been protected for so long and isolated from the world for so long that they were making substandard products at high prices, taking the consumer for a ride, and it was just a bad scene. And in the mid-90s, when competition started coming in and the first signs of Chinese imports were coming in. I remember the membership of the CII saying, you know, we will be wiped out. The same people who are today globalizing and acquiring companies and going out into the world, because they did restructure. They learned from the 97 to 2002 crisis period after the Southeast Asian financial crisis. That really, you know, was a shock for the Indian manufacturing industry. And they learnt a bigger lesson. The IT sector of India, the Infosys, the Wipros, the Tata Consultancy Services, they are the first companies of India in the 90s to engage the world successfully. And when they engaged the world successfully, the impact of that went way beyond the IT sector. It gave a sense to others that we can also stand up and be counted. And the manufacturing industry, what you see today, is a great force, and you will see them growing more and more, not in the labor-intensive very simple technologies with volume production where China is excelling. I don't think we will go down that road, but we will be in more complex, automated, engineered products, which are more niche products like automotive components. We are doing very well in the world. Forgings and all kinds of industrial products where India is showing its competitiveness even against China, you know, where China has been strong. So I'm very confident that as government, which is an enabler, it is not a restrictor now. It's not a constrainer. It's giving, you know, there's a national manufacturing policy being evolved. There are more support infrastructure being built for manufacturing industry. But one thing the government is saying all the time, and I think that's very, very important to stay with that, competition is good for Indian manufacturing. Competition is the best thing for Indian manufacturing because it brings out the best in our entrepreneurs. And our entrepreneurs are world class. So I think you're going to see a growing manufacturing sector in India going forward. But they will be in more complex and more engineered products, unlike the Chinese. We will not fill the supermarkets. We will not be able to fill the supermarkets of the U.S. with made in India products, you know, because we will be in a different area of production.
If I could add a footnote to that, the one area where manufacturing is not successful is in the defense sector, which is largely restricted to the government and the government defense research development organization, DRDO, and the government arsenals. And there the quality is ambiguous at best, to use a euphemism. Apocryphally, Indian pilots ask whether this plane is made in India or Russia, you know, and whether the tank is Indian made or Russian made. But that may change because, in a sense, they're beginning to open up even that sector to private enterprise. But then you get the question of war, you know, as the state has to rely on the weapons and this guarantee a source of weapons. That's a complicated issue. Yes, next question. Right over here, Ms. Right. No.
Sudha Meyyappan, Manchester Trade. Always a pleasure to hear you speak. My question is based on the Doha negotiations. It is one place where India has shown a good kind of leadership, but also it's been blamed to a large share about why the talks have failed for so long. So the reason that India gives is that its agriculture sector, it's not willing to open up. I'm glad you mentioned the agriculture sector. So what is being done in a way that can be consolidated, it can be empowered? That's number one. And number two is the private sector in India active or recommending to the government anything on the multilateral negotiations? How much private sector has a say in something like this? Do they ask the government, please go ahead with the talks and somehow come to a conclusion? Is there any role? Thank you so much.
Let me give you a couple of examples of FTAs, which have been successfully concluded by India. Let's take Singapore, for example, which is a kind of a completely free trade economy, right? The whole world exports into Singapore, buys out of Singapore. We have an FTA with Singapore. When the talks started, again, private sector was very, very inhibited and scared. So we ran roadshows around the country to explain to our businessmen as to why a FTA would not be harmful, would actually be beneficial. Cut a long story short, FTA has been done. Trade and investment have, you know, grown rapidly, 20% per annum. And this is the story of all the now FTAs that India has done with the ASEAN. They've signed with Korea. They're about to sign with Japan. Just the last bit is left on the pharma industry issues to be resolved. And we are negotiating with the EU. By the way, we are ready to negotiate with the US also. All right. Now, this is all bypass surgery because the WTO talks are not, you know, coming to a conclusion. India, I think, was wrongly advised to almost take credit for blocking the WTO talks earlier. That's the way I would say it. I think we had some real issues on agriculture. I think we could have worked around that. There is a new initiative now. The agriculture hasn't changed overnight, but the Prime Minister is taking a new initiative to say that let's move ahead on WTO. Let's try and find a via media on WTO. The private sector has been very supportive, both on the FTAs and on WTO. See, the private sector is not a major player in agriculture. So it doesn't become a stumbling block where agriculture is concerned. The private sector really comes into the issue where services are concerned and manufacturing is concerned. Now, on the services sector, really, we have more to offer. Our offers on the table are probably frightening some of the other countries away, because one of the things we are saying is free movement of people, professional people, and certainly the Western countries don't want that, you know, because they have their own issues of low growth, they have their own issues of unemployment, and so one can understand that each country is coming from his or her own perspective in this. So the reason why we are reticent on agriculture is the 600 million poor people. If you free imports of agricultural products, then the farmers who are what we call subsistence farmers, how will they live? They're already having a difficult time surviving. But I think we can work around this and we can phase it out so that, you know, we can open up imports in a graduated way. I think where work is going on this. They're trying to develop things. But I think all countries are not ready now. You know, I think right now I would say the West is having more difficulty in these issues because of they've gone through a very bad time on the global financial crisis. So I think they need to come out a little more, have a little more confidence in their own economies and their own growth before we can move ahead on WTO.
Tarun, the agricultural sector is private, but it's disorganized. Is that right?
Yeah, very much so.
Back there, sir? Anybody? Okay.
Alyssa Ayers with McLarty Associates here in Washington. Mr. Das, thank you for spending a couple hours with us on this gloomy day outside. I wanted to follow up on something you said about India trying to build a new social and economic development model. And I wanted to ask you to offer us a little bit of elaboration, your assessment of where you think the political consensus is heading on this idea of a new social and economic development. So, for example, it has seemed for the last, I don't know, I would say maybe last 15 years or so, that the transformation taking place in the Indian private sector was very much, if we think of sort of a pendulum of public opinion, that perhaps that pendulum was much more on the side of veering towards growth, emphasizing growth. But I feel like, just from my own observations in the last year or so, that the pendulum may be swinging back towards emphasizing inclusiveness over perhaps growth. And I just wondered if what your assessment is of that and where do you think things might be headed?
Alyssa, you know, the growth story is now firm in the ground. You know, it's kind of embedded in the Indian national scene. So there's no compromise on heading for 9%, 10% growth year on year, because that's the only way you're going to deal with poverty and the developmental challenges of India. And, you know, India has every problem in the world. So the growth story is there and will continue to be there. But I think what we've all realized is if we don't take everybody along with us, then the internal security issue which you talked about is just going to get worse and worse. So we have to take special initiatives to empower people. And this is where this social reform agenda, which I talked about, various things, the food security bill, the right to education, more healthcare infrastructure facilities, all of that is happening. Interesting to, this is my, nobody's told me this, this is my guess from the outside, that while the economic growth story has been led by Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, Monte Kaluwalia, Chidambaram as finance minister and all that, the social reform agenda, from what I see from outside, is being led by Mrs. Gandhi. And I think that her focus is very much on the social side. That's why I'm saying that. So there are these two movements taking place. The social thing is coming now It's kind of catching up with the backlog. It's coming strongly, but the two will converge into this 10% growth story more and more. Because if you don't take care of the social side, we are not going to get the 10% growth. We need more empowered people. We need more educated people. We need more skilled people. We need women to be empowered more, and all of that, so that the nation moves more as if it's on one bicycle, not two bicycles, going in parallel, one ahead and one at the back.
Yes, ma'am. We'll give you a microphone. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sananda from McClatchy Newspapers. I was wondering if the inclusive growth strategy of India will reach out to all the states, especially some states which doesn't have friendly government or the center-friendly government, such as West Bengal.
I think all the states, and I must tell you that even in the opposition states, let's take Madhya Pradesh, which is in the center of India, which is a very backward state, which is run by the main opposition party, BJP. There's a lot of work being done at the grassroots level, involving NGOs, industry, government working together. So I think it's across. The real challenge for us is the northeastern states. 8 states in the northeast and all backward. Very difficult to have industry there, manufacturing industry. So it's got to be services sector. Also, if you want to protect the environment, you can't have polluting industries there. So it's services sector, it's tourism, it's food processing, it's fruit processing, that kind of stuff, and skilling people. What's happening now is, if you go to India, if you go to Bangalore or Delhi or Bombay, you'll find girls and boys from the Northeast working in the hotels there. You ask, you see the girl or the boy and you say, where are you from? Say, I'm from Manipur. I'm from Assam. I'm from Nagaland. There are no jobs there. That's not good. So we need to get development going in those states. And one of the issues there, again, is going back to the first point, is about security and law and order, because there are issues there. So we're trying to deal with the law and order issue, trying to do with development and creation of jobs. But the biggest challenge is, irrespective of who's in power in the states, is the Northeast. And that challenge still remains as a very big challenge for us.
This gentleman over here. Right here.
Yeah, my name is Kunle Jovetimi. I'm from the EIR. I just wanted to, thanks for hearing you speak. My question and also a comment also will be, with the recent trade developments, scientific, technological, and industrial between Russia and China late last year, and also with the need of the Asian region, because it seems to me right now there's no denying the fact that the whole of the Asian region is now going nuclear. There's a lot of trilateral, bilateral agreements on nuclear energy to improve the living conditions of the people in Asia right now. Actually, so just that in your presentation, you did say that 80% of the people in India are poor and live in the rural areas. So is the situation in China also. They have the same problem. So my question would be to, in order to meet those scientific, technological, and industrial, and also agricultural needs, don't you think that, I don't know if you think this, but I don't think that in order to meet those needs, India, particularly, and also China, will not be able to accomplish those goals under the axioms of free trade and globalization. There's no denying the fact that under those axioms of free trade and globalization has contributed largely to the international global breakdown crisis that we're in. So my question is, what do you think? This is like a hat out of the bag, if you might say. Having the four nations, because right now the future of the world is oriented towards the Pacific, the United States, Russia, China, and India, to come together and form a new international credit system, not a monetary system, so that in order that each nation will be in charge of their own credit currency. So I wanted to see what your thoughts would be on that. Thank you.
The first point which I need to make is that we don't see any way to stem or slow down globalization, because it is to do with technology. And even if at difficult times a country tries to be protectionist, this is a temporary phenomenon. It's not something now in this world of innovation and technology, which you know, crossing borders is not a problem anymore. So that's not a solution. Second, I don't think it's going to be possible to have a India, China, Russia, US kind of a quadrilateral arrangement, because the whole ASEAN region, 10 countries, are enormously rich, and most of them are doing well. So if you look at a country like Vietnam, it's developing very well. Singapore has been through ups and downs, but you just see the economic strategy report they brought out for the next 10 years, saying where Singapore will go, their vision for the next 10 years. It's an amazing document which shows how a nation, even a small country, is thinking about its future. So I think we have to work with all these countries. And by the way, Japan may be going through difficulties, but it's a very strong economy still. And it has strong contribution to make to the global economy and trade. So on the one hand, I see globalization continuing. I see trade becoming freer and freer. And I really see that this is good for the world. I'm afraid I'm not coming from that. You know, all my life I have fought for freer trade and freer investment, because that was bothering India very much. And I thought keeping India back in terms of its potential and achieving its potential. So the space that India has got because of globalization has helped India to come where it is. It's not a global power. It's not a superpower. It will not be anywhere near that. And maybe we don't even have ambitions like that. You know, there's one famous politician who says it's not about GDP, it's about GDH, you know, gross domestic happiness. That's more important than gross domestic product. And so, and you know, there is a very strong spirituality in India. It's not about religion. It's about spirituality. Which is self-denial and sacrifice and saving is all part of our culture. So I'm not sure that we'll ever make it to the you know, top rungs of the US-China situation. But I think we have to keep driving the freer economy, the freer regime, but with regulation, with those controls. I think the financial crisis happened also because there was inadequate regulation. I don't think that's an argument for going against globalization. And I think the growth will come for all by connecting with all, not having exclusive blocks.
Let's take just a few more questions, although I'd like to, we could have ended on that note, but take a few more questions. Woman in the back. Oh, Angie? Yeah.
Angie Hassinger, I'm retired. I wonder if you could expand more on the sort of employment patterns you expect over the next 10 years, given the focus on knowledge economies and the manufacturing you invest in, Ray region, Ray industrial sector, Ray urban, rural. Can they cope?
You know, the biggest challenge for us today and the major shortages are in the very basic skills. You know India well. You know that unlike, let's say, a developed economy, India still has servants, all right? Let's domestic servants. Now, are there trained servants? Are they taught? No, they are not. They just learnt on the job. Today, there are schools for domestic servants. Ah. We are going to see 100,000 skilled domestic servants. And this revolution, or evolution, I'm not sure what this word revolution, is being led by a British woman. Her name is Sean Ranekas, and she is doing this in Delhi, and it is being replicated around the country, so that there will be, over the next few years, men and women who are trained domestic servants, right? So their salaries will go up, their terms and conditions of service will improve, and they will be more empowered than, much more empowered than they are today. And in the same way, there are lots of basic skills where we are facing shortages. Because of the security situation around the country, we need security guards. We need security guards, again, in hundreds of thousands. So there is a major effort going on to train people, you know. So it's not just about the knowledge economy. I think those people will come out of the engineering colleges or wherever and you know, and they will find jobs now that the growth is back to 7.5%, heading for 8%, heading for 9%. Those people are getting back into the corporate sector. Our worry is about the millions of people at the very ground level of Indian society. And so the 500 million people, a lot of it, a lot of them are at this basic level, you know, where skills need to be taught. And we are organizing ourselves to train people, to train trainers, so that we can empower people in this way. So the focus is there, not so much on the higher end.
Let's just take one more question. This, what time is it? Yeah, we should. Well, two more questions. This gentleman here, please.
Nimai Mehta from American University. I'd like to come back to the manufacturing sector in India, and especially its role in generating employment, because it's one would think that inclusive growth would have to include a generation of a large degree of employment through manufacturing, through industry, much more than what we are generating right now. And so how far is India, do you think, on reform of its labor market? So whatever keeps the formal employment sector still below potential?
I'll divide my response into three parts. The large manufacturing industry, very briefly, is not about employment generation. The large manufacturing industry has to compete in the world, especially with China, who are very, very competitive on manufacturing, very low cost, and very capable quality manufacturing coming out of China. So don't look there for employment. Whatever is the minimum they require for doing their job, they will do. The manufacturing sector which will give you employment is the SME sector, which I talked about. That will be far less capital intensive, more employment intensive, and will give employment. But the third point which you mentioned, labor law reform, it's, you know, I keep hearing this all the time wherever I go in the world, and it's a kind of usual stuff thrown at us. I'll give you an example. The British multinational, headquartered in Calcutta, communist government. 66% of the blue-collar workers are fired. It's not one line in the newspaper. Nobody's saying anything about it. How come? Because we have no social security in India. So the British company goes, talks to the state government and says, we cannot afford to keep these workers, these thousands of extra workers from the old days. All right? All right? You give them more compensation than they are due under the law. The law says 15 days salary per year of service. Now, on 15 days salary per year of service, that guy cannot look after his wife and children and educate his kids. Remember, there's television going on. Every kid, everybody wants a cell phone, and everybody wants a better aspiration of life. So he gets not 15 days per year of service, maybe he gets 45 days per year of service. So he goes to the trade union, negotiates a good deal with them, way beyond what the law offers, and he gets rid of his workers. Labor law has not come in your place. So what we are doing is, industry is downsizing where it needs to downsize, by working with the trade union and working with the government, but giving a compensation package which is more liberal. so that the people who go out of jobs can live, can retrain, can do something else, or set up a shop, or go back to their land, or whatever. And this is happening. And companies are also appointing psychologists to or counselors to help the blue-collar workers to relocate, to retrain, and go on to do. So there's a whole new game in India today, which is not about law, but it's about communication, consultation, and working together.
One last question. Okay, brief question, brief answer. Yeah.
My question is about corruption. One of the major impediments to India's development has been corruption. Corruption at three levels, one at the political level, second at the bureaucratic level, and third at the corporate level. What credible measures are being taken to combat that? I'd like to get your views.
I think the first tranche of initiatives on this was to remove controls. Because every time you had to go for a license or an approval to the government, money passed hands. All right? And a lot of that has gone now. Some remains, particularly in some sectors like real estate. You want to construct a house, you need 27 approvals. You want to build a hotel, you need 35 approvals, you know, all of that. So elements of that part are still there. Second, the Right to Information Act is being used extensively in the country today by common people, by NGOs, to question government decisions and they have to divulge the internal decision-making process, notings on files, in awarding a contract or whatever, you know. So I think that's another very good process helping transparency where we're coming from. But at the end of the day, it's a huge problem still in the country. So I share your concern, but I also see that we won't be able to deal with it overnight. We also need people want to live better lives. So they do irregular things to earn more than they are earning from a government job. So all this is going on. But I think we are trying to move away from that by making decision-making more transparent. And that's the only way is to make, you know, and I, for one, am recommending to our government that what President Obama has done in having a chief information officer here, in bringing transparency into governance, is a huge thing, and we should do that over there. We apply information technology to all decision-making, government procurement and licensing and all that process so that we can really open the whole book, and then it makes it very difficult for anyone to, you know, ask for money. So, tough question, long way to go, but we are heading in the right direction slowly. I think there are many corporates now who are not giving money. You know, where does this corruption thing, the root of it is the election funding. And the politicians need a lot of money for campaigns. Corporates are now allowed to give money by check. That's been a huge thing. So corporates are now giving, and they're declaring it in their balance sheet. I have given, you know, 10 million rupees to this party for, you know, for election. It's legitimate expenditure today. So we need to do these things more, but ideally we should have state funding of elections like the Germans do. Should have state funding of elections, give a certain amount of funds to the candidates, and so that the pressure from them on the corporates and on the individuals for money is minimized. We need to go down that route. Dr. Manmohan Singh is the author of the report on state funding of elections. But the Congress Party has yet to bite the bullet.
Tarun, I have a question that hasn't been asked. I wanted to ask you that. But before that, I would comment. I'm from Chicago. And Chicago used to be very, very corrupt. In recent years, it's still corrupt. More aldermen have gone to jail than have gone on to higher office. So it's still a corrupt city, but it's a more effective city. And Mike Weiner, years ago, wrote a famous article on corruption in India. And, you know, corruption can be functional. It can grease the wheels in an inefficient system. It can also be dysfunctional. So by itself, it's not a problem. The question I have for you, Taryn, and I think this has been a splendid, you know, tour de horizon of the really critical issues of a country that is undergoing these revolutions. I still like to use that term. What do you worry about the most? What area or what sector really makes you concerned, keeps you up at night in terms of Indian development and equitable growth?
The point which worries me most is the first question which was raised here is about the Maoists and the Naxalites in the center of India, because they are not wanting to talk anymore. They only want violence. And I think that is a really worrying situation. So we're working at it, but I think it's a huge problem. It was neglected for many years. So it's become a much bigger problem than it should have been dealt with much earlier. People didn't see it coming, didn't see the size, you know, growing. So for me, that's a... Fortunately, it's not hitting the main economic and business centers of the country. You know, it's down the center, but it is hitting where the mineral resources are. So mineral resources are located there. That's a heavy forest belt. So these people are actually hiding in the forest, thick forest. They're operating out of there. So for me, that's a big challenge. But I'm also very, you know, comfortable with Chidambaram as a home minister. I would rather have him as home minister than finance minister because he was a tough finance minister. So let him be a tough home minister.
Please join me in thanking Tarun Das for a splendid...